He's regularly written about. He's in the media all the time. You still do him if you read A-level geography. He's everywhere, but very few people actually ever read Malthus himself.
That was Robert Mayhew talking about the political economist Thomas Malthus.
And it was a time of great change, and people weren't sure what was happening. And I think that was one of the features that he latched onto in writing his sensation novels, that people were sort of slightly on edge.
And that was Andrew Lycett describing how Victorian novelist Wilkie Collins reflected the period in which he lived. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. It's available in all good newsagents, or you can take out a subscription from wherever you are. Visit historyextra.com/subscribe for the latest subscription offers. And we have many digital editions available for the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. If you want details of any of them, visit historyextra.com/digital. Thomas Robert Malthus's essay on the principle of population caused quite a stir upon its publication in 1798, with critics going on to label its author, among other things, a reptile, an ass, and a booby. But Malthus's work, with its argument about human population and the lack of resources, continues to be influential. Robert Mayhew, who has written a new account of Malthus, met up with our books editor, Matt Elton, to discuss the reality of the man and his ideas.
So what first appealed to you about writing about the subject?
I think what first appealed is I think that he's regularly written about. He's in the media all the time. You still do him if you read A-level geography. He's everywhere, but very few people actually ever read Malthus himself. People talk about Malthus, they don't read him. And it seemed to me important to try and explain what he actually said, because it's not what people think.
Okay, and obviously we'll touch on what he said in a bit.
Yeah.
For people who might not know, could you explain the background of his life, I suppose?
Okay, so Malthus is alive in the late 18th and early 19th century. He's really easy to remember because he lives 34 years either side of 1800. So it's nice and easy. And he's a scholar and a thinker. He's a pioneer of modern demography. And therefore, in a broader sense, he's one of the founding fathers of modern social science, I guess. And so that's where his contribution lies.
And so what were the main kind of tenets of his argument, I suppose?
Okay, so he writes a book called An Essay on the Principle of Population in 1798. That's the book he's remembered for. And the main argument he wants to make is that population always tends to outstrip the resources it needs to survive. So we have a problem. We're always going to have more mouths to feed than we have resources to feed them. The reason this matters, because we think that's fairly straightforward now, the reason this matters is when he wrote, a lot of people thought the bigger the size of your population, particularly governors, rulers, kings, the bigger the size of your population, the better, the stronger you were. He's arguing, no, it can actually destroy your society rather than empowering it. So that's why this matters.
And so his was quite a negative view in that sense, or...?
Not negative. That's the normal view of Malthus. He's gloom and doom and negative. No, what he's saying is that policymakers, rulers, need to be aware of this potential problem and need to think, how do we respond to it? Where you have resources, he thinks it's good if population grows. So that's the sense in which he thinks a large population is good, but only if you have the resources to sustain it. To merely and randomly want to encourage procreation, as Denmark does now, to merely and randomly do that is a problem unless you have the resources to sustain it.
Okay, so what did he suggest to do to help solve this problem?
So he basically says there's two ways in which population can be kept in balance with resources, the bad and the good. The bad one is the one he's remembered for, which is that he says nature can do the adjustment for you. Plague, famine, war will cut your population back to fit the cloth that your resources provide. But that's not exactly an ideal way to adjust your population. So he basically argues the good way to adjust your population to resources is something he calls the preventive check. So late marriage, limiting the number of children you have in marriage. Also, and this is the one he's controversial for, he thinks that the state should not subsidize children where families cannot actually support them. So he's very hostile about what he calls poor relief, which is, of course, the late 18th century equivalent of benefits, I suppose, in the present day. So he thinks that the state system is allowing people to have children they can't support, and he's very critical of that.
Okay. Do we get a sense of how he views the poor as a people?
It's mixed. So if you look at how Malthus is received, how people respond to his writings, he's seen as the great enemy of the poor, the man who'd happily have them starve. There's something in Dickens' Ebenezer Scrooge that's about Malthus. If there's a surplus population, let them die or go to the workhouse and do something useful. Now, there's an element that it's true. Malthus is actually quite critical of the poor in the sense that they need to plan their family size and make sure they can sustain it. But there's another way in which what he's saying is actually we should be trying to make sure everybody has a quality of life, everybody can be sustained. And the interesting thing is when the crunch comes in England in 1800, there's a very large problem feeding the population. He writes a pamphlet, and at the end of it, he says that for all the problems of poor relief, he'd rather it were in place and that people were saved by it than that they died. So ultimately, there is a humanitarian side to him in his attitude to the poor, although it's not the one people tend to remember.
Mm. I mean, you've touched on that, and that his views tend to get kind of locked into a certain position on things. Did he, in fact, change his views throughout his life?
Yes. So he's known for what he wrote in 1798, and he's normally attacked for that one book. But he carried on writing for another 36 years until his death. And his views do change and they do soften. I think there's two main things here. One, he becomes much more interested in the rational ways in which we can control population. So how we control our family size as individuals, how the state incentivizes people to have the right family size. And he increasingly over his life thinks that can be effective, i.e. we can plan our way out of problems. We don't need famine, war, pestilence, etc. So that's one thing. And the second way in which he changes, I think, is that he becomes much more interested in, instead of asserting things, finding evidence. So he lives in the era of the birth of the census, our modern way of understanding populations. The first British census is 1801. So 3 years after his essay, and his essay is influential in why it happens at all. And for the remainder of his life, he's very interested in what do censuses around Europe tell us about how population is working. And because he becomes much more interested in data, he becomes much more cautious in what he says. Rather than asserting things, which is what, as a young man, he does in 1798, he becomes cautious, he becomes nuanced, and he starts to think that the dynamics between population and resources are much more complicated.
Okay. And in terms of his views, I suppose, what factors can we see as shaping them?
Do you mean what drove him to write? Or?
I suppose what external factors that were kind of inherent in the period in which he was alive shaped his thought?
I think the single biggest one is the French Revolution. So we think of the French Revolution, 1789, of course, but in Britain, the French Revolution becomes a hot issue again in 1798 because people are fearful that the revolution is going to come over the Channel and sweep through England. That's when Malthus writes, and that is clearly why he writes. The subtitle of the book makes it quite clear that he is attempting to attack radical utopian arguments that we need an equivalent of the French Revolution. That's the single key reason he writes. And he wants to say that because population always outstrips resources, you cannot have a utopian ideal society. There will always be hardship. There will always be a tendency for us to have problems controlling and feeding our population. So I think the French Revolution is the single key reason he writes. But as I say, in England, that means he writes in 1798, not 1789.
Yes, I understand. You've mentioned Dickens. He had a lot of criticism from Dickens and poets as well, criticised him. What sort of things did they say about his work?
Well, there's a couple of main strands, and one which is very strongly in Dickens and the Romantic poets is that Malthus, who is a clergyman, that's his profession, that Malthus is unchristian. Because, of course, the Christian doctrine is one where charity is at the core. And, of course, Malthus is saying that charity is a problem because it allows us to sustain people who otherwise can't support themselves. So Malthus is seen as anti-Christian. That's one of the strongest reasons why Dickens, the Romantics, a whole series of people, right down to the present day, actually, criticise Malthus. I think the other main thing that the Romantics want to say, of course, is that Malthus's image of the natural world is, it's a bit like, we might get to that, it's a bit like Charles Darwin's. It's a place of vicious competition, a struggle to survive. And of course, the romantic doctrine of nature, Wordsworth, Coleridge, they're writing at exactly the same time as Malthus. The romantic doctrine of nature is that nature is an intimation of God, leads us somewhere higher. And therefore, there's this clash between different visions of what it is to be a human being in the natural world. And I think that's why the poets in particular are so negative about Malthus.
Some of the things they write are really harsh when you look at it. It's just incredible.
I mean, Southey, who was the poet laureate later, says that Malthus's book is a diarrhea of the intellect, which is a lovely phrase. But yes, and that's only one amongst many of those sorts of quite fruity comments.
Mm. Some of them were hugely personal, the attacks on him. What do you think led to that level of kind of anger, I suppose, almost?
I think the fundamental thing is, again, this sense that he is violating basic Christian tenets. Of course, the Age of Enlightenment that Malthus comes at the end at is often seen as secularizing, but I think in Britain, Enlightenment is still a strongly clerical and Christian phenomenon. And I think that Malthus, it's this sense that he's offending our basic sensibilities as a Christian nation that most upsets them and leads to that vitriol. The strange thing is that whenever any of them meet Malthus personally, they like him, because for all that he's known as this ogre in print, personally, he was a nice family man, well known for his sense of humour. He then taught at a college and the students loved him. So whenever anyone met him, that sense of antagonism tended to dissolve. But when you just read him, there was this huge sense that he was an ogre.
What were his views on the natural order of things then, I suppose?
It's definite that Malthus's view of the natural order is it's God made. It's a Christian view. It's also his argument in the essay that the fact that we have to struggle is good. The fact that we need to work hard to survive is good because that leads us to innovation and technical and social advance. This is not what people think Malthus says, but that's because they don't tend to read the last two chapters of the book. They don't get that far. That's where he says this. So nature is a place where we struggle to survive, but that is a divinely built injunction, that's a divinely built system. And the reason we struggle is that that allows us to innovate and to stretch our human capacities of reason, innovation, and in modern terms, entrepreneurship. So that's his vision, and it's very different from the romantic one.
So it's actually quite a positive vision in that sense, not the negative vision that some people have him at all. He's saying that humans can improve to meet these challenges.
Yes, so I mean, this is why I think Malthus is misunderstood. If you do A-level geography, if I'm allowed to talk about that, you're told that Malthus is negative about our ability to survive, and that modern critics are positive. It's a false dichotomy, because Malthus, by the end of the book, is doing something that's profoundly an Enlightenment understanding, that through reason we will advance. Because nature forces us to reason, we have societal advance. So Malthus's big picture argument is that because nature is a tough place to survive, that's actually the main engine of social advance and individual advance. And therefore, it's a profoundly enlightened story of progress. But what it isn't for him is a utopian story with the French Revolution, which for him is not grounded in the facts about how nature works.
That's something that we haven't touched on, actually, is the idea of there being these utopian writers.
Yeah.
Who were these people and what were the things that they said?
Okay, so Malthus's essay, as we remember it, nice short title, has this long, very boring 18th century subtitle. And what it tells you is he's attacking two people called Mr. Godwin and Monsieur Condorcet. William Godwin is the leading English radical thinker of the early 1790s. He marries Mary Wollstonecraft, the great early feminist theorist. Their daughter is Mary Shelley, author of Frankenstein. That's the person that Malthus is attacking. And then there's Condorcet, who is a French philosopher, who is in the end, he dies in 1794. I best check that's right. He dies in 1794, I think it is, and that's because he's essentially hounded in the Terror. But he'd initially been a huge supporter of the revolutionary government. Both of them are social scientists and philosophers, and both of them argue the thing they share is that we're moving towards a perfect society. Condorcet in particular says there are 10 stages in human history, and that the French Revolution is the threshold between the 9th stage and the 10th, when we will achieve utopian perfection. Godwin likewise argues that the empire of reason will be such that soon we, for example, won't want to procreate and we will probably live to be immortal. because our lifespan is expanding and he thinks that can continue indefinitely. And it's against this that Malthus pitches his argument, no, we'll probably still want to procreate, which history's proved him right on that one, I think, and that no, we won't have an indefinite lifespan. Yes, medicine can improve our lifespan, but it will not become infinite nor even indefinite. So he thinks that these theorists, William Godwin and the Marquis de Condorcet, are essentially engaged in a fantasy about reason and what it can do. And instead, what we should do is ground what we think about nature, population, in the evidence, what we can actually demonstrate.
In terms of the people that were influenced by this work, are there any particular figures or schools of thought that you think are particularly important?
Yeah, I mean, I think the obvious place to stop here is Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, I think. Malthus has many impacts in the history of ideas, and of course that's what the second half of my book is trying to chronicle. That's the legacies of the subtitle. But I think the single most important one is his impact on Darwin and Wallace. It's well known, of course, that both of them essentially came up with the idea of evolution at the same time in 1858-9. And Wallace in particular actually had a lovely phrase 50 years later in 1909. He said that Malthus was equivalent to the match which, when struck, lit the flame of their idea. And so both of them argued that Malthus was key to understanding evolution. And the reason is that Malthus gave them the idea that nature is this constant struggle for resources, a constant struggle to survive. And of course, what they do is take an argument Malthus has for the human world, for human societies, and they translate it and say this explains natural societies and the competition between species for scarce resources. So it's basically taking Malthus and applying it to the natural world is their insight. And I think that's the single most important moment in the reception of Malthus's ideas in terms of making the world and the mental world that we live in today.
Mm. There's some ways in which his ideas have been used fairly problematically. For instance, in the States, there's some examples, and elsewhere, I suppose, in the world. What do you think has led to this misunderstanding of his views? For negative reasons, I suppose, if you like.
So you're thinking about eugenics and trying to forcibly control population. Well, of course, it's a fairly simple step from saying we can tend to have too many people on the planet to saying, in our modern world, technologically, we can control it. So if people are of lower mental capacity, however that's determined, or if we deem them to be alien and irregular, which is what Hitler was good at, we will lead to forcible sterilization. In the United States, it's estimated about 75,000 people were forcibly sterilized, and this policy was only stopped in the early 1970s. So surprisingly recently, in fact. Why is it that Malthus is deemed part of that? Because he said the population size is a problem. But let's be clear, Malthus himself was very straightforward in saying that it should be an individual's decision. It should be your individual reason that leads you to control your family size. It should not be state compulsion. As I've already said, of course, about the poor law, Malthus is very critical of the state intervening too much in individual lives. And because he's a thinker from the Enlightenment, he thinks that our own reason should lead us to this conclusion, not state compulsion.
Are there any other ways in which you feel sad that his views have become distorted?
I think the main one for me is this idea that Malthus is doom and gloom and pessimism. In fact, Malthus is quite the reverse. He's saying that through struggle, we lead to something that's quite optimistic, which is the flourishing of reason and the expansion of our technological capacities as human beings. So it seems to me that the really sad thing is that Malthus's story has been reversed by people who only read, well, say half of it, who don't read the conclusions. And that means that we profoundly misread what he was trying to tell us. But that's been the case from the beginning. From day one after his book was published in 1798, we've had these misunderstandings. That's one of the main reasons I wanted to write about him.
What kind of things do you think we can do to help reverse this misunderstanding, apart from your book, of course?
I think the main thing is actually read him. There's nothing a historian would ask you to do more than go back to primary sources. Malthus's essay in its first version is not very long. 150 pages in a modern edition, 55,000 words. Just get to the end of it and you'll find that Malthus is not the person you may have been told about at school, or is not the person you think of if you use the phrase Malthusian. He's much more complicated, varied and interesting than that.
You mentioned teaching there. Is there a change in the approach that we use in schools to this subject that would help, do you think?
I would love it if people stopped teaching a very simple story, which is Malthus versus a Danish economist called Esther Boserup, who wrote it in the 1960s. She wrote some very influential and important material about developing world economies and demographies. And what she tried to argue, based in particular on her experience in the Indian subcontinent, was that actually population expansion leads to technological advance, i.e. it's a positive stimulus. But as I say, that's exactly what Malthus wrote as well. And so I'd love it if we stopped pigeonholing one as doom and gloom and one as positive. And we in fact saw there's a more complicated dialogue across the generations about this interaction of population, resources and social advance.
So it's not simply one versus the other.
Exactly. It's not black or white.
In that sense, people that criticise him for in some way his theories not coming true, what would you say to those people about the difference between what he predicted would happen and what actually did happen?
He doesn't tell you, when people say that Malthus got it wrong because we live in a world of 7 billion people, etc., Malthus didn't say that we were about to fall off a cliff and have some vast demographic Armageddon. He never said that. He indeed says in his later writings that he can't imagine us ever reaching that cliff. He thinks we'll always be innovating to new solutions and therefore that the total population the Earth can support will expand over time. So he understood that. So I think to the question, was Malthus wrong? The answer is no, he was exactly right, in fact. In his later mature writings, he precisely understood that technological advance meant that the number of people the Earth can sustain is not a fixed number that we can set in stone. It will be a number that varies over time. And he was, I think, even willing to understand that the total number we could support would stagger him. So in the 1760s and 70s, people were already thinking the Earth could sustain a billion, which is actually about the number of people that probably were on the planet at the time Malthus wrote. And they're also writing that technology will allow us to do a lot more. So I don't think Malthus would be surprised, and I'm quite clear that a world of 7 billion people doesn't prove he was wrong.
How can we see his influence continue in today's society?
I think that's one of the things that most surprised me writing this book, is that as a historian, I get very nervous if I have to write about anything too recent. But the last chapter on the book actually tries to come down to today. And one of the things that most surprised me is how much people are still talking about Malthus in the present day. You've got public commentators, Neil Ferguson, John Gray. You've got people like John Beddington, who was chief scientist in the UK. They're all still talking Malthus in the present day, and so is the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. They're still thinking in Malthusian terms, how do we mitigate population expansion and what it does to climate? How do we respond, etc.? So I think Malthus is still in a lot of places today, both academically and in public policy. That was the thing that most surprised me writing the book. He is everywhere. My only worry is Malthus is everywhere as a name, but he's still not actually being read. I'm not at all clear that any of the people I've just mentioned would have read Malthus to talk Malthus.
What was the biggest challenge for you in writing this book?
I think the biggest challenge was trying to come all the way down to the present day. Most of my work until now has been really about the 18th century. To try and track these ideas and how people responded to Malthus down to the present day, that was difficult. But also it's because there are so many strands, many of which I couldn't fit into the book, where Malthus is picked up on. So it's not in the book, but Nietzsche, for example, the German philosopher, is very interested in Malthus as well. There are all these strands. And as you come down through the decades, it's like the heads of Hydra. Every time you think you've got the story, the number of things you have to deal with multiplies. So it became a sort of unmanageable by the end. That was the hardest thing to do with this book, to follow as many strands as possible, but also to cover them properly so that the reader understands what they said and which ones to let go. That was painful.
Mm. Were there any others that you let go that you would have liked to include in the book particularly?
I would have liked to probably say more about, you touched on it earlier, about eugenics than I did, because I mainly talked about eugenics in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But as I said with the American case, eugenics as a story comes down to much closer to our own era. It certainly comes down to our own lifetimes. It's not something in the dim, distant past. And that would have been something I'd have liked to follow more.
Mm. If you could somehow travel back and ask the man a question, what would you ask him?
I'd ask him to confirm with me that he wouldn't be surprised if 2 centuries later there were 7 billion people on the planet and that we were predicted to have 10 billion by about 2050 or 2060 if the United Nations are right. I'd ask him to think about that, and I'd ask how that fitted with his theory. As I've already said, I think he'd be very comfortable as to why that's occurred. He'd be amazed at the technologies that have been involved, of course, but I think he'd be quite comfortable. That doesn't prove him right or wrong. It just shows some of the ways in which his thesis can be applied in different contexts. So I'd love to see what he made of a world of 7 billion people.
That was Robert Mayhew. Robert's new book, Malthus, The Life and Legacies of an Untimely Prophet, is out now, published by Harvard University Press. We'll be running a review of the book in our June issue, which is out in a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, you can still get hold of the May issue of BBC History magazine. This month, we're leading with the story of Queen Elizabeth I's war on her Catholic subjects in the 16th century. Plus, we're charting the adventures of British spies in Italy during the Second World War, exploring the scandalous reigns of the Georgians, and investigating a curious tale of cannibalism on the high seas. If you like the sound of any of that, then why not pick up a copy at all good newsagents or via our digital formats? It's now time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarlane.
Richard III may have wished to be buried in Middleham, Northamptonshire, London, York, or County Durham, leading historian Michael Hicks has said. Speaking exclusively to History Extra, Hicks said that at one time or another, the last Plantagenet king envisaged being buried at least five different locations, none of them Leicester. Hicks said, "Richard died a traitor with all his possessions seized by the crown. He died intestate, as though without making a formal will. Therefore, we do not know for sure where he wanted to be buried, but I believe there are a number of possible places." You can read this story in full at historyextra.com. In other news, a number of people visiting Auschwitz, the Nazi death camp where more than a million people died during the Second World War, are scratching messages onto bedbugs and removing so-called souvenirs, it has emerged. According to the Telegraph, administrators of the Auschwitz Museum have said that in some cases, vandals have etched their name with the tag "was here" onto walls and furniture, while others have stolen items such as bits of barbed wire and spikes from the railway line that transported people to the camp. The museum's operators say the size of the camp makes stopping crime difficult, and Poland's culture ministry, which is responsible for the museum, said it opposed the installation of CCTV systems given the environment of the camp. Meanwhile, a prestigious independent school is to become the first in the country to make history compulsory for sixth form pupils. Pupils at Brighton College will spend an hour each week studying history on top of their chosen A-levels, but will not have to sit exams in the subjects, the Argus reports. The headmaster told the Times that the move was in response to the disgrace that the subject was not compulsory in the UK beyond the age of 14. Do you think history should be compulsory in schools? Share your view by tweeting us at History Extra or by posting on our Facebook page.
Thanks for that, Emma, and don't forget to visit historyextra.com for all the latest history news. Before our next interview, here's a reminder that tickets have gone on sale for our 2014 History Weekend Festival. Taking place from the 16th to the 19th of October in the Wiltshire town of Malmesbury, the festival features talks from dozens of leading historians, authors and broadcasters, including Hilary Mantel, Paddy Ashdown, Dan Snow, Earl Spencer, Susanna Lipscomb and Tom Holland. To find out more information and to purchase tickets, please visit the festival website, historyweekend.com. The English novelist Wilkie Collins is perhaps best known for his mystery and detective novels, The Woman in White and The Moonstone. But as Andrew Lysett, author of a new biography of Collins, explains to Matt Elton, the author's own life was also masked by secrecy.
Well, my previous book was a biography of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, and I got interested in the origins of the detective story, and I was sort of looking around for other things that I might write as a sort of serial biographer. I was talking to a publisher who suggested this and suggested that Wilkie Collins would be an interesting character. I mean, he wasn't really thinking, you know, along the same lines as me, and that I was interested in the detective story. You know, he just thought it was an interesting part of Victorian culture. You know, an interesting story, really, of this author who was a great friend of Charles Dickens, whose brother married Dickens's daughter, who lived a very unconventional life and who had two families, although he wasn't married to either of the women involved. So basically, it was, as far as I was concerned, it was partly my interest in the detective story and the origins thereof, which, of course, one looks to The Moonstone, which is Wilkie Collins's great detective novel. And also, when I looked into a bit more about Wilkie Collins, I did indeed find that, you know, he was a fascinating character that was well worth a biography.
Mm. So, I mean, for people who might not know, you've outlined briefly there. I mean, what was his career? He wrote a series of kind of fairly forward-thinking novels, I suppose.
Yes, he was born in 1824, the son of quite a well-known artist, a member of the Royal Academy. So, you know, he was part of the sort of establishment. And Wilkie reacted against that. He was a bit of a rebel from pretty early age. And Wilkie was associated with the artistic world throughout his life, really. He was great friends with the Pre-Raphaelites, who were the people who came along in the late 1840s and kind of reacted strongly against the formalism of the Academy. Friends of Wilkie's were people like John Everett Millais, William Holman Hunt, and he used them to illustrate his books and things like that. And he was, it sort of took a little while to find his métier. He worked initially as a tea broker, which seemed unlikely, but that was what he did. He read for the bar, and eventually he sort of began writing stories. And again, it sort of took him a little while to sort of really get into his stride. But by the 1850s, and particularly after he met Dickens in 1851, he was really, you know, he really began to, you know, establish himself on the literary map. You know, he was very, he'd spent most of his life in London, pretty well all his life in London, and all, most of his life very much in one particular area of London, Marylebone, which was where he was born and died and where he had his main house in Gloucester Place. So he was very quite plugged in to the literary and artistic world in London and indeed in Britain. So, you know, he started sort of emerging in the 1850s. His first great sort of great success was his novel, The Woman in White, which was published in 1859. Thereafter, you know, he was very much, you know, he was probably one of the highest paid writers in Britain. There's no doubt about that. You know, he was, became very wealthy. And for about 10, 12 years, he was really at the top of his game. That period sort of lasted from about 1859, as I say, the date of the Woman in White, till 1868 in particular was the date of The Moonstone, and just maybe a couple of years after that. During that period, he invented, more or less, a kind of genre of writing which is called the sensation school of novels, which was basically a particular type of novel that kept readers on the edge of their seats. It was designed to keep people turning the pages and to want to go on. I mean, it used all sorts of devices, drawing on all sorts of things of the past, a bit of gothic, a bit of horror, a bit of detection, which was something that actually he developed. And he also kind of really kind of alighted on a particular theme, which was that there were a lot of secrets hidden under the underneath the sort of trappings of Victorian society, and he did his best to try and uncover them, and that was what his plots were all about. He had various themes that he wanted to expose. I mean, he was very concerned, certainly in his books, about the position of women in society, and that accounts to an extent for the fact that he's been sort of rediscovered in the last 30 years. The very specific things was that he saw that property law was not was sort of acting against women's interests. He wrote several novels around the theme of the marriage laws and how little differences in the legislation in different parts of Britain, i.e. in Scotland, the law was different from Britain, and how this was manipulated sometimes. This was a theme of his novels. In The Woman in White, you get him latching onto a particular theme of the time, which was that people were inclined to try and put their relations into asylums. And this became a bit of a scandal because there were these private asylums. Doctors could be prevailed upon to sign the chit and sort of put people into asylums. So the plot of The Woman in White is, again, a very complex one, but partly it's about a woman who is wrongfully in an asylum. And the point there is that Wilkie was latching on to an issue of the moment. He was, he worked as a journalist with Dickens on Dickens's magazine / newspaper, The Household Words. And so he was often writing topical articles, and that gives a topicality to all his work. There was always a sort of sense that Wilkie was tapping into what was going on in society.
I mean, there's a couple of themes there that we'll draw out later in the interview, but the one I wanted to pick up first was this idea of secrecy that comes through in his work. How far is it fair to say that his own life was defined by secrecy?
Yes, that is a very good question, actually, because that is the kind of the dichotomy or the kind of curious feature of Wilkie Collins's life, because and it's also it's not unusual in writers and artists, I think, that he was obsessed with this theme of secrecy. He certainly wrote a lot about it, but he at the same time as sort of in his writings appearing to want to uncover secrecy, in his private life he was determined to keep as much of it as private as possible. So it's interesting, the development of the theme of privacy. You get that in The Moonstone in a kind of different kind of way, because you get the detective going into a private house and trying to uncover the, what had happened as far as the theft of the Moonstone was concerned, and the woman who owned the house sort of feeling that this was an intrusion. I think that there's absolutely no reason to think that privacy, which is very much a kind of topical thing in our culture, is a modern thing. I.e., people were concerned in the changing times, sort of Victorian, early Victorian world. I mean, as I say, Wilkie was born 1824, and then he sort of came into his own in the early years of Queen Victoria. And it was a time of great change, and people weren't sure what was happening. And I think that was one of the features that he latched onto in writing his sensation novels, that people were sort of slightly on edge, but they hadn't quite got used to the sort of the changes that were happening.
How unusual was Wilkie Collins' home life?
Wilkie's home life was quite unusual, and that was, in a way, one of the attractions of Wilkie as a biographical subject. Wilkie was not the typical Victorian. He wasn't a sort of gung-ho rationalist, even in the way that you might consider to be in the case in the Victorian times. He wasn't a great materialist. He was a bit of a pacifist. He didn't support the Crimean War, for example, in the 1850s. He was somewhat unusual in his sympathies for women and their sort of position in society and their the way that they suffered under the vagaries of man-made law. But at the same time, you know, he carried on his life as he wanted to lead it. As I already mentioned, he had two families that initially he became, he lived with a woman called Caroline Graves, who was a young widow whose husband had died from tuberculosis. And Wilkie met her in Marylebone. Like a lot of his life was revolved around Marylebone. She was working in a marine store, which is really the kind of the lowest of the low at the time. You know, it's a bit like working in a junk shop today. And people were sort of suggesting that, I mean, she was really at the sort of the nadir of her fortunes. People have suggested that she may have been working as a prostitute. People also suggested that she was the model for the woman in white. But anyway, Wilkie set up house with her initially in a kind of rather seedy little part of Marylebone. Eventually, they moved to rather better house in Gloucester Place. But while Wilkie was living with Caroline and indeed with her daughter, Harriet, whom he was very good to, whom he put through school, etc., he met another woman while out researching a novel called Armadale. And this took him to Great Yarmouth in 1864. And he developed a liaison with a woman, a very young woman, called Martha Rudd, who came from pretty much an illiterate farming family. She was working as a barmaid in Great Yarmouth at the time. Somehow or other, Wilkie prevailed on her to come to London, and he established her in a flat in Marylebone again in 1868. And I know that because one of the interesting sort of research tools that I was able to call on was Wilkie's bank accounts. You know, there's various things that a biographer can call on, obviously letters, etc. But in this case, he banked at Coutts, and Coutts has a good sort of archive, and it was able to share details of all his inputs and outgoings, etc. And I was able, you know, I saw obviously that he was paying the rent on this these lodgings in Marylebone from a particular date in 1868. I was also able to see another aspect of his unconventional life was that he was a great imbiber of opium, and or often in the form of laudanum, which of course was pretty widely available in Victorian times, which played quite an important part in his life because he suffered badly from gout. And so he took ever-increasing amounts of laudanum. And strangely, I mean, I don't think it really sort of affected him as a drug. I mean, the pain often affected him, and he would be under, you know, he would be suffering when he was trying to complete novels, etc. But he managed to live with this, you know, what was called an addiction to opium. He took vast quantities of it. I mean, there was a story about him and a friend who went to Switzerland, and you know, Wilkie was feeling that he needed his fix of opium, and they had to go to four chemists in this particular town in Switzerland in order to get the amount that Wilkie needed.
Is it fair to say that he became less popular during the later stages of his life? And what do you think caused this?
I think it is fair to say that he had his great heyday in that period, in the particularly the 1860s. Thereafter, and this may be attributable to his intake of opium, he seemed slightly to lose his creative flair, and his novels became a little bit more not prosaic, but polemical, in the sense that he latched onto themes. Now, I indicated that, you know, there was always a sort of topical aspect to his novels, but he kept that in check. But after about the mid-1870s, the sort of polemical aspect of things became much more prevalent, and he would write about themes much more obviously, so he would be talking about, for example, he wrote a novel, Heart and Science, about sort of attack on vivisection. People began to notice this, and for example, the poet Swinburne, in his capacity as a critic, he was quite sympathetic to Wilkie, but he wrote a much noted, much quoted what can only be described as a put down of Wilkie Collins towards the end of Collins's life. Collins died in 1889, and Swinburne wrote, "What brought good Wilkie's genius nigh perdition? Some demon whispered, 'Wilkie have a mission.'" Wilkie's kind of desire to get his points across was really he was doing that at the expense of his creativity. And
what most surprised you during the course of your own research into this?
I think what surprised me most really was how sympathetic Wilkie was. I didn't really know too much about him, I didn't know about him personally. And I discovered that, he was a very warm, sociable chap, whom everybody seemed to like. I mean, it's very hard. I can't actually think of anybody at the moment who disliked Wilkie. You know, you can have a debate about the extent to which he treated his women well, and that's an interesting one that I've had lots of conversations about, because, you know, there he was with two women. He wasn't married to either. Somehow or other, they might have had a better life otherwise, or they might not. You just can't really say.
That was Andrew Lycett. Wilkie Collins, A Life of Sensation is out now in paperback, published by Windmill Books. Well, that's almost all for this week. Do get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we'll do our best to read out some of your messages in future episodes. And now we've had some more contributions to the debate about our theme music. And so far, most of the messages have been positive, but we've had an alternative view from Julie Houston. She writes, "I was so glad to hear someone else raise the issue of the theme tune. I agree with Andrew and would actually say that I loathe it. I rushed to forward the podcast so that I miss as much of the theme tune as possible. It, for me, is the only negative thing about the podcast which I enjoy very much. I would be so delighted if it was changed. I wait with bated breath." Thanks for that, Julie, and please keep your comments coming in about this discussion or anything else. And as well as email, you can keep in touch with us on social media, follow us on Twitter @HistoryExtra, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/HistoryExtra. And do make sure to check out our website, historyextra.com, for all the latest history news, quizzes, galleries, articles, and previous episodes of this podcast that date back right to 2007. Next week, we'll be talking to Orlando Figes about the history of Russia, while Matthew Parker will be offering his thoughts on the Battle of Monte Cassino. Do join us for that. This History Extra podcast was recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.